into the final session. Let's get serious. Halachic infertility. It's not halachic. Infertility. So we've chosen this as a theme for ending, and usually Sunday mornings we try to bring everybody back together. So this concept of going out and then coming back in together, we have this unity, works well. It's a good moment. And we try to pick a topic that has some broad social implications. So this year we're going to explore the idea of infertility. We're going to look at it from a social perspective, from a rabbinic perspective. We're going to look at it as well from a halachic perspective. And then we have some local expertise, and then we're going to hone in on a few specific cases which will speak to the broader topics of some of these issues that come up with it. And to lead this program this morning, I'd like to call upon Rabbi Bulka, who will be addressing the issue of the social and rabbinic issues in infertility. This slide that he's looking at saying, I'm not speaking on that. That is the, for all of you in Toronto who are going to enjoy the weekend and Monday night, that's tomorrow night, Rabbi Steinberg. Okay, Kosher Live Free Daftem. All right, so, and if any of you want to make a day of it and come via Toronto, anyways, this should be a very exciting program. And I turn to Rabbi Bulka.
Well, you're turning away from me, you're not turning to me. I just want to let you know that all the coffee for the whole weekend was decaf.
Not from the way I saw the crowd.
No, because apparently that's what the caterer told me. Listen, I have a good place for you to have your thing next year.
Where?
Have it in Ottawa. It's going to be the 150th anniversary.
That's right.
But if you're thinking of doing it, I would do it now. Because hotels are going to be hard to get. And by next year, the new light rail is going to be around here. It's going to be so you're going to worry about where to go. There's going to be a whole light rail exhibition right across the street from the hotel.
Can you get us Trudeau to come?
Huh?
Can you get us our Prime Minister to come?
You want him? Maybe. Okay. The other thing I want to let you know is I'm in the very generous spirit of this morning. And if you take a look in your books, I'm slated to go from 9 till 10:30. Look at it very carefully. Right? See that?
But then you have a chabrusa from 9:30 on.
Yeah, okay. But I will not go that long. So let me begin with some... Let me begin with a few... Firstly, it has been absolute a delight over the course of Shabbat to be with you. And again, thank you to Rabbi Jay and to Dr. Laser and to everyone, including the wonderful Rabbanim that I've met here in depth for the first time. It's been a real... it's a real zchut to be here. Let me begin by making some simple observations that I really don't need to tell you, but let's start with them anyway. Most mitzvot that we fulfill are easy in terms of what you know you have to do. You know, you go to a tefillin store, you buy tefillin, you get a good pair, and you're off to the races. You want to daven, buy a sitter, not a big deal. The mitzvah pruvu, which is the first mitzvah in the Torah, ironically, is one which is very complicated, because you may really want to do it, but you can't do it alone. And you therefore have to find someone who likes you enough that they're willing to get disfigured and go through lots of privations in order to have children. It's not an easy thing. So first you have to attract that person, then you have to marry them, and then you have to hope that this is going to work. but because of the fact that there is a big mitzvah to have children, then mitzvah sometimes generates pressure. That is to say, it's a mitzvah, I have to do it. So if I have to put on tefillin in the morning, not a big deal. I set the alarm clock, make sure I'm up in time for the minyan, and I go. But sometimes the desire to do something creates so much of a stress and an anxiety that it actually works in the opposite direction. So it's interesting. If you take a look at some of the literature on infertility, there was a while that people thought that the anxiety caused the infertility. That we got a little smarter now. Basically, we, generally speaking, we more or less, except the idea that it's the infertility that causes the anxiety rather than vice versa. Although they can both be operative, especially in religious families where, let's say, a few years goes by and what's happening over here, and there's expectations, you have to have kids and the kids aren't coming. The social pressure, which is not disassociated from also from a sense of shame, like what's wrong with you that you don't have children. So those are issues that operate chiefly, let's say, within a community where having children is an expectation. But let's now go backwards a little bit and think of it not so much in Jewish terms, but in general global terms. Firstly, how do you define infertility? How long does a couple have to go before this can become a problem? So the WHO, which is not my favorite organization because it's associated with the United Nations, which is my least favorite organization, says that it's at 24 months. In other words, if after 24 months, no pregnancy, so we can consider this an infertility situation. There are others that chop it down to 12 months. I think it's best for us to operate along the idea of infertility. From a medical point of view, if you're going to go to a doctor 1 week after marriage and say, I don't have a child yet, or I'm not pregnant, the doctor will say, Hakmanishka Chinik, come back a few months from now. But over a protected period of time, we can more or less say that infertility is something that you intuit from wanting it and it's not coming in its normal time. And it's not merely, let's say, just having no children when wanting one. Infertility could be if, let's say, one is there or two and you want to have three, four, and five, which is very much the reality in the religious community. So the fact that a person has two, even if they fulfill the legal, technical obligation of pru or vu by having one boy and one girl, but the pressures are enormous to have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I remember a couple who were actually going crazy. They're not in Ottawa, so I'm not divulging anything about them, who had 9 children and desperately wanted a 10th and was going 7, 8 years without a child. And for them, it was as if, not that they neglected the other children, but for them, their definition of infertility was the 10th one is not here. The United Nations would laugh at that, but we don't laugh at that. Infertility affects probably 15% of the population, and we should not downplay this as just simply a thing, you know, like I didn't get a lottery ticket and I didn't win. The consequence of this. By the way, Jay, what's a good stop time? Laser?
9:40.
9:40?
Yeah.
Okay, so lift your hand up when I'm at 9:40 or 9:39. Okay? All right. Thank you, sir. One of the major problems with infertility is, and it shouldn't come as any surprise to you, there's a high rate of depression amongst people who are infertile. Various different reports about what the rate is, whether it ranges all the way from 15% to 54%, and it's based on a comparison between that and the general population. And by the way, that depression is not only on the wife, but also the husband. It wouldn't come as a surprise that there's a higher rate of depression reported amongst the women, but the significant percentage between them is not that great. It's only a few percentage points. So they both feel it. It doesn't mean that they both react in the same way, which it can lead to problems we'll get to in a few seconds. Suicide rates amongst infertile people. A general report, which is actually quite scary, that amongst those who have had a procedure to treat infertility, which was not successful, 1 out of 5 report having had thoughts of suicide. So we're dealing here not with a small problem, we're dealing here with a major problem with major psychological and social implications. Some of the people have drilled down on what really goes on in somebody who is dealing with infertility is, number one, that for example, women have reported that the measured reaction of women to this is somewhat like women who have found out that they have heart disease or cancer. This is their reaction. In other words, the anxiety level, the disappointment level, the depression level, we're talking about a serious issue. And many of you who have studied the human reaction to cancer, which involves shock, the denial, the anger, the bargaining, the resolution, Kubler-Ross's famous subdivision of the emotions. And by the way, there's no halacha that you have to go through all those things. Firstly, it's best if people don't have cancer altogether, unless their names are Abbas and other people. Is this being taped? Okay. But for those people, this is what they go through. And ironically, that's what many of the people who are wrestling with this, if they find out a verdict, the doctor says you have a fertility issue and it's a serious one, they go through that the various stages. So this is not a problem to minimize, it's a problem to really take very seriously. There's a dent to a person's self-esteem, that's that famous all-encompassing, this is the fibromyalgia of the psychological world. Self-esteem is implicated in probably every single issue that involves a person's emotional well-being. Guilt is a major issue involved in infertility, especially if it involves, let's say, either a woman or a man whose past sexual history has not been stellar, and they will, whether they are right or wrong about this, are going to blame themselves for the fact that they have this problem. Then you know you get from self-esteem to guilt. It's not a nice trip to go on. And there's also other guilts, like, for example, the guilt that your in-laws and your parents who desperately wanted to have grandchildren and you're the conduit to their grandchildren and you're not fulfilling it, so you feel guilty about that. There are all sorts of interesting emotions. So there are a lot of things that you have to sort of parcel out be able to distill when dealing with this problem. Marital discord is also a big casualty, especially if the husband and the wife are not on the same page, where the wife takes it much more seriously, the husband not as seriously. So that is a major issue, and just a warning, God forbid, if you ever see a situation like this and people are asking you for quick advice, if you want to give them a nickel advice, it is whatever you're doing, do together. That is to say, don't send your wife to the doctor. Go with her, unless the doctor doesn't like you. But seriously speaking, make sure that whatever it is, it's, oh, it's your problem, go ahead and take care of it. You have to make sure it's our problem, not yours. Otherwise, you're going to get going in different directions. And by the way, this is the same type of thing that happens, God forbid, with things like SIDS, which is sudden infant death syndrome. We hear less of it now than we used to. But again, one of the marital challenges in this is that the husband takes it much less seriously than the wife, usually, and then they go off in different directions. The husband's already gone on to bigger and better things, he thinks, and the wife is still suffering from it. She doesn't understand why he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand why she doesn't just get over it. Big, major problems that you have to go into. Now, there's also the issue, especially in... It, maybe in religious circles not as pronounced, but the idea of social isolation. What happens if all your friends have kids and you don't, so you can't go with them with a baby carriage for an afternoon pizza or something like that. And I can imagine in some places where that's the way they do it, this could be a major issue. So all sorts of interesting implications that happen with this, and with social isolation comes a sense of, who are going to be my friends now? And you have to, when you're choosing from the younger population, they all have kids. You got a major problem. Your choice of who you're going to have as friends has become severely limited. Then there's the other issue of you're stressed out because you want to have kids, but then the stress of having this problem begets even more stress about how you're going to solve it. And interestingly enough, some reports have shown that if the first visit to the doctor, which we think is the stepping stone, because we have great technologies now that we didn't have generations ago and decades ago, somehow if that doesn't work, it creates even greater anxieties. Because going to this, you have the anticipation, oh, the doctor's going to take care of me and I'm going to be okay. And then if it turns out you're not okay, you say, oy vey, I'm doomed. So some of the reports of emotional stress have been higher after the first treatment, and the first treatment didn't work. Then there's even the issue of going to a doctor for treatment. Not everyone is happy with that. There's this social issue. I know you may laugh at it, but a lot of people think that life is in their control. The way the life cycle is going in the outside world today is, I'll get married when I want to, I'll have kids when I want to, and you just like you snap your fingers and say, the kids are going to come. So if I marry by choice later on in life, and that too is an issue because the infertility rate, which affects, as I said, 15% of the population, it's not getting better outside because people are getting married later. And then when they want to have the children, the window of opportunity is much less because they're already older, and that we say the biological clock is going, and if they don't get into the right position at that point in time, then the stress is even greater because you don't have a window of 20 years to work with. So all of this by way of saying that so many of the social niceties of today, which include getting married later and then just having children when you want, and then if that doesn't happen, all of a sudden you say, what, I'm not in control over here? It's not coming when I want it? So you know what? I don't know what Dr. Klayman wants to talk about this later on, but very often the people that they take it out on are their doctors who are there to help them, but it's the doctor that is showing, you know, we're going to help you to get out of this mess, but that's to say, I need you to get out of this mess, so they get angry at them because they've lost the control and they think that now the control is in the hands of the doctor. So there's all sorts of interesting psychological implications about this. Now, the major reason why women today and men outside of the Jewish world want to have children is because they see it as a source of fulfillment and happiness. For us, I would say we go into it saying this is a mitzvah that God placed upon us. It's not that we don't anticipate nachas from our children and working for it, but that's the primary motivation, I would say, is not just simply to have fun times with them, it's to fulfill our obligation to give birth to the next generation and to promulgate all that we are asked to promulgate in our having children. Then there's another issue, especially for those who are getting married later on in time, is who's going to take care of me when I get older? So children are an investment in the future. So you say, when I get older, my kids are going to look after me, unlike what I did with my own parents, right? So if you don't have children, then goes into your head and says, okay, what's going to happen with me when I get older? Who's going to look after me? So that type of disappointment is also part and parcel of what's going on. let me, having just given you a few of the niceties and the not-so-niceties about this, and I hope it has given you some idea. We can go a lot further, but I don't want to go over the time that I've allotted. Let me go backwards now to this issue from a Torah perspective. Very simple. If you go through the Torah, especially from the beginning, infertility is a theme that you cannot escape. Every single one of our avot experienced the challenges of infertility. And every one of them dealt with it a little bit differently. And you can see almost, I don't want to make any conclusions, but you can see almost, because of the way the marital situation was set up, how differently they reacted. Let's begin with the general idea that all of our avot had these challenges. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov all had these challenges. Not all the imahot. The only one that didn't have this challenge was Leah.
She had secondary infertility.
Huh?
She couldn't get pregnant when she wanted a second time.
Right.
She also had infertility.
Oh, okay. All right.
Secondary.
Secondary, right. That was like the one from 9 to 10. Right. Okay. Very good. So why did this happen? Not an accident if all the avot had to. So the interesting, looking at the verse, Vayeta Yitzchok L'Hashem L'Nochach Ishto Ki Akorohi, which somebody say that Yitzchok prayed opposite his wife because she was infertile, barren, whatever, however you want to translate it. And the order is reversed, according to something that should have said, Vatehi Rivka Akoro, and then Vayetar Yitzhok. So from this is derived the idea that God wanted this because God loves the prayers of the righteous. I'm going to give you a little bit of a different slant on it a little bit later. But there was another interesting, fascinating midrash. Too long, implications are wonderful in the sense of saying that God wanted them to have together time for a long time so that they really could develop their love together, not, let's say, compromised by pregnancies. It's a very interesting thing. But what this all tells you is that, and I'm not diminishing the severity of the issue, but that in the process of trying to address it, there's also opportunities. There's opportunities for becoming more and more together, for expressing love and unconditional love one for the other. These are things that we shouldn't lose sight of. So let's begin with the way Yaakov Avinu addressed the issue. Yaakov Avinu had this problem where Rachel said to him, "Havali banim v'in ayin beisa anochi." That was a very challenging saying. He said, "Give me children, because if not, I am dead." If you take a look at some of the Meforshim, they're basically mind-boggling. Ramban, for example, suggests, take a look at the last part of Ramban on the Pasuk, that Rachel was saying that if this is not going to happen, I don't have children, I'm going to afflict myself to the point where I'm going to die. Was she hinting at suicide? No. But she was hinting at self-flagellation to the point where she would not have been in the world anymore. It's quite a fascinating insight into this whole issue of infertility. Yaakov's reaction was to get angry, and Midrash is very upset with it, imputing to God that God says to Yaakov, this is not the way that you deal with people who are in such torment. What you have to do is be more sensitive. And he said that later on, it'll be destined that one of her children, all of Leah's and others' children are going to have to bow down to him. Quite fascinating. In other words, from Yaakov Avinu we learn how not to react. It's not by anger. And it doesn't make a difference if it's male infertility or female infertility. Your spouse is there to be supported, not to be blamed and not to be shamed. You take a look at Avraham Avinu. His way of dealing with it was different. Remember that in the case of Leah and Rachel, there were other factors that were involved, including the fact that Leah was really producing many children, and there was probably more than just the issue of infertility there. Going back to Avraham, so he had the same issue, and what he did was give over to have another wife added to the entourage, you know the problems that generated. That too was not without rancor and marital discord between Avraham and Sarah over the course of their different understandings of what this child was supposed to mean, whether it was Sarah's kid via the Pilegesh, or whether it was actually Avraham's kid. And that basic, very interesting dynamics. The model that we should have in our mind for how to deal with infertility is Yitzhak and Rivka, which, by the way, if you have to ask a question, I firmly believe that they had the best of all the marriages. Not because it was the only one with the Avot and the Imahot that was a one-to-one, but I think that they were on the same page throughout their entire life. But what happened? We say that Vayeta Yitzchok Lashem Lenochach Ishto. Basically, what happened was Yitzchok prayed to God opposite his wife. Do you know how uplifting it is to see your spouse praying for you because of a difficulty that you have? And it is so, shall we say, it is so much of a lift to the love relationship between the spouses when you see that your mate really cares about you and is davening for you. By the way, it's a good thing too, is sometimes when a patient comes to a doctor and there's a doctor says, there's nothing more I can do for you, we tried everything. Just the idea of a doctor and a patient praying together has been shown over the course of many studies that this is a great thing for the doctor-patient relationship, good for the doctors, good for the patients. Davening is very powerful. But the most important thing that it does is that it strengthens the relationship. It makes this into something which, as I mentioned to you before, which is of inestimable value, that you're traveling this road together and you're in it together and you're going to solve it together. And if, God forbid, it doesn't get solved, but you are together, which takes away some of the loneliness and isolation that unfortunately is part of infertility. Let us all be blessed that those of us, all of us who want, will have the bracha of it. And thank you very, very much.
No, after.
You're going to introduce Lori?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
You could stand for a few.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Bulka. Moving along, we're going to discuss now some of the ironies that following the halacha sometimes puts people into a situation of infertility, and the term that has been coined for this is the issue of halachic infertility, and I'd like to ask Lori Novick to address this issue.
Okay.
And how long should I be going for?
28 minutes.
No promises. Okay. Rabbi Bilka already introduced two ways in which religion can play a role, or particularly our religion can play a role in the experience of a couple facing infertility. One is in creating an added level of pressure to have children, which can complicate the picture. Another is... Another is as a resource, that looking at the model, for example, of the avot and the imahot can be something that a couple can draw on. But as but as you might imagine, this only becomes much, much more complicated if halacha itself is playing a role in what seems to be the problem. What do I mean? Well, Chazal already recognized that typically a woman conceives close to her tefillah time. Unfortunately, there are many kallah teachers that try to sell Hilchot Nida in part by saying that it optimizes the odds for conception. We don't have any record of any kind of statement like that by our sages. But we do have a statement in Masechet Nida, that Eini Sham Mitaberet Ela Samuch LeTefilata. It's around the time of tefillah typically when a woman is going to conceive, and that's because ovulation tends to be around the time of tefillah. But the problem of halachic infertility is one in which a woman ovulates before she reaches the mikveh. And it's possible to ovulate before one reaches the mikveh and still to be able to conceive. But it's much harder. Why? The fertility window. Sperm, typically it looks like sperm can survive for about 3 days once following relations within the woman, though there have been studies showing women who've been able to conceive even 5 days after having relations. The optimal time, however, to have relations in order to conceive is typically said to be in the couple of days prior to ovulation. The maximum fertility window is one in which one has relations anywhere from 5 days before to 1 day after. Really, the optimal fertility window in terms of when a couple should try to have relations if they're trying to conceive is shortly before ovulation. This works out great for let's say, a typical Ashkenazi woman who, let's say, has a classic cycle length and is going to the mikveh on night 12 and is going to ovulate a couple of days later. And she's going to wind up, presuming she has relations with her husband on the mikveh night, they're going to wind up having relations, the perfect timing for her to be able to conceive. However, things don't always work that way. There are a lot of variations from woman to woman in the time of ovulation. Ovulation, there's a little bit of a myth that ovulation is consistently 14 days prior to the onset of the next cycle, but really the length of the luteal phase in different women can vary from 12 to 16 days. And that means that you're going to have some women who would be ovulating prior to mikveh, even if their length of time bleeding is not prolonged. Additionally, you have some women who spend more time bleeding, who have longer time bleeding. Some women might only bleed for 5 days. Some women might bleed for 7 days, 8 days. That's within the medical norm, but it means that she's not going to make it to the mikveh as soon as she might like. And then you also have some women who just have shorter cycle lengths. That woman might still be ovulating 14 days prior to the onset of her next cycle, but if her overall cycle length is shorter, then we're going to have a problem. There are a lot of different ways in which a couple can wind up having a scenario in which the woman has passed her fertility window before they've ever had a chance to have relations. It is worth remembering that the egg, the ovum, does survive within the woman for about 24 hours post-ovulation. So it's not the case that any time a woman is ovulated prior to relations, she won't be able to conceive. Okay, so it's possible, let's say, that a woman could ovulate the day of mikveh, or even possibly later on the day before, and still be able to conceive naturally. But it's more difficult, and effectively what we've done, the farther along in the cycle we get when we have mikveh immersion arising, is we've shortened, or we've reduced the opportunities that the couple can have to have relations that can lead to conception. In terms of what we do in practice and how we deal with women dealing with this issue, Rav Bolka talked about a two-year window. Generally speaking, the recommendations, I work very closely with Dr. Dina Zimmerman, who's done a lot of pioneering research in this topic, both taking data from clinics in Israel for women's health and also doing independent research work. The recommendation that we generally work with women is that if it's a younger couple where there's no additional health concern, we give them a year before we'd say that there's enough concern that they should be checking things out medically. If it's an older couple or if there are other medical considerations that might affect fertility, then generally we'd say after 6 months that it's worth checking out. The truth is, though, that often couples don't even get that far. This is a very, very common question for us to receive as Yotzot Halacha. It's a very, very common concern that women have. If you add to the general concern women have about whether their cycles are normal, how they're adjusting to their sexual relationship within marriage, how they're working with the laws of Nida, this concern about, and the general consideration and concerns women have about, am I fertile until they've first been able to conceive and deliver a healthy child, if you add to that the concern that a woman might be ovulating to mikveh, it's ovulating prior to mikveh immersion, it's a perfect storm. In Dina's research, one thing that she has found is that the incidence of what we would call halachic infertility is quite likely lower than one might think. So though prior studies said that roughly 20% of women, of Jewish observant women who were reporting fertility problems, suffered from halachic infertility, the claim that she and our colleague Tova Gansel made is that the number is closer to something like 6-8% of women already seeking help with fertility problems within the observant Jewish community. The thing is, however, of course, that for that 6% is still too great a number. And for those women, they're dealing not just with the regular gamut of fertility concerns, but they're also dealing with a situation in which it seems as though they're being punished for keeping halacha properly. The Torah that they want to turn to, the God that they want to turn to, for support, as a resource to comfort them as they move through the challenges of fertility, if the case really is that the only reason they're not conceiving is because of the timing of the immersion, halacha itself seems to be a problem. And that can create a real crisis of faith, unfortunately, for a lot of these couples. The first thing that we do when we face women who are dealing with these issues is we try to get accurate information. It's very frequent for women not really to be aware of precisely when they're ovulating. Even certain indicators that one would think would be very clear, such as cervical mucus, which becomes sort of like the consistency of egg white around the time of ovulation, is a good indicator. Women can misread. We've had many cases of women who were convinced that they were ovulating prior to mikveh, only to discover that they were actually ovulating much later in their cycle than they thought they were. And in fact, the reason they weren't conceiving was because they weren't being careful to have relations closer to when the ovulation was, when actually they were fully permitted to each other. In general, if a woman is trying to conceive, a couple is trying to conceive, it makes sense to track ovulation. But in these cases, it's essential, because before we can deal with helping a couple with this problem, where this problem also, as we've mentioned, can present a sort of crisis of faith, it's important to identify with some certitude what sort of problem we're dealing with, or if there even is one. And there's a range of ways in which a woman can track her ovulation. The first thing that's important to know is that tracking ovulation can vary within the same woman from cycle to cycle. So even if, let's say, on a given cycle, a woman is able to recognize that she's ovulating at a time that would be too early for her to be able to conceive, it doesn't mean that that's necessarily happening to her on a regular basis or every month. So one of the things that we start with is to explain to a woman that tracking or identifying or diagnosing this problem properly entails giving it a few months to see what's really going on. How do you do that? Well, there are things women can do on their own. There are the typical group of fertility signs that women who practice the fertility awareness method practice, that in this purview they can look at their cervical position, they can look at, as we mentioned before, the cervical mucus, the basal body temperature is going to go down and then go up around the time of ovulation. They can use, now they're very easily available, ovulation predictor kits, which detect the LH surge. You can get them at a local pharmacy without any kind of a subscription. There was a time when those were prohibitively expensive. Now they've become really very reasonably priced, so that's something that a woman can do on her own. There's a test for there's ferning in the saliva. There are changes in the electrolytes in the saliva and the cervical mucus. So there are different ways in which a woman can get a reasonably accurate picture on her own. But the truth of the matter is that to have a really accurate medical diagnosis, the best thing is to see a physician. The physician can order also blood tests, and the physician could also order a series of ultrasounds. Here I should stop for a minute and just mention that sometimes there's a tendency we found for not only the woman to jump to conclusions, but also for a physician to jump to conclusions. It's important for a physician, I think, in this situation, to take the time to properly diagnose or determine when a woman is ovulating before necessarily assuming that this is at issue. And there have been cases where it seemed to us, dealing with women, where physicians have quickly rushed to talk to a woman about treating her medically without necessarily taking the time to track what's going on. Of course, this depends on the couple, and it depends on how much time they have in terms of age, what have you. As I should have mentioned before, as women get older, it's not just that their general fertility goes down, as Rabbi Belka mentioned, but it's also that cycles tend to come close together. So that in terms of secondary infertility in particular, women who never had a problem might experience this issue later on in their lives. After there's some sense medically of what's going on, we're reasonably confident, let's say, that on a fairly frequent basis, the woman is passing her fertile window before she is reaching the mikvah, the next step that we like to go through with the woman is to discuss halachot. Why? Because it's frequent that women reach the mikvah later than they ought to. We know this with a lot of experience with women, not just dealing with fertility issues, but women in the general population who make assumptions, generally stringent assumptions, about what is or is not acceptable on bedikah cloth, what they can't or cannot do, when they're allowed to make a hefsek tahara or not allowed to make a hefsek tahara, how clear it has to be, what have you. And our first step, staining, they might assume that staining is going to preclude them from making a hefsek tahara when it won't necessarily do so. Sometimes women who are even actively staining might even be able to get through clean days. So there's a range of situations in which a woman's level of halachic knowledge can affect when she's reaching the mikvah. And by clearing up or providing more halachic education, we can help a woman reach the mikvah 1, 2, sometimes even 3 days sooner. That takes care of the problem in and of itself. This is another step that unfortunately often gets skipped, meaning Something that can frequently happen is that a doctor determines that a woman is ovulating on a regular basis prior to reaching the mikvah, and they move ahead to talk about ways to treat it. But this missing step is very important. It's important not just in terms of the immediate problem, which is enabling the woman to conceive. It's important in terms of her intimate life for the rest of her marriage. Why should she be spending more time in Nida than she's halachically obligated to do? And I think it also has great significance in terms of the crisis of faith that may accompany women's experience of this problem. Because if a woman, as part of the process of determining how to deal with what's going on, is given to understand that the halachic system has certain ways that, that there might be answers for her, a resolution for her within the halachic system itself, or that at least such discussions are worth having, at least she feels that the halachic system is not closing the door to her, that there's a reason that the rabbis are there for her, that the Yotzei Halacha are there for her, that there is something to be gained by looking closer at the halacha. Beyond that, there's also sometimes room for greater leniency with certain halachot when dealing with women with these issues. For example, a rabbi who in general might be more stringent about the amount of bedikot a woman performs or about what to do in a case of a borderline color on a bedika cloth might, in a case in which a woman is struggling to conceive, rule more leniently. A woman is not going to know that unless she's consulting with her rabbi about the issue. I cannot tell you how many times we've heard from women that they were certain they were getting to the mikvah as early as possible, and a conversation or two with the Yoetzet Halacha rabbi and forcing themselves to bring cloths for evaluation and to try to perform a Hefsek Tahara earlier, discovered that for years of their lives, in fact, they've been going to the mikvah late. A last item to mention, which depending on the judgment of the rabbi might be applicable at this stage or might be applicable at a later stage, is the question about whether or not there's room halachically to shorten the amount of time spent in Nida, aside from the question of what type of bleeding she has. By which I mean that we have the 7 clean days which are absolutely fixed and cannot be touched as a matter of a concern for Torah law. But we also have the 5-day waiting period beforehand. For women who are bleeding or part of their issue is bleeding for longer than 5 days, this doesn't help. But there are some women, it's frequent with short cycles, who also have shorter times that they spend actively bleeding. For those women, in some cases, there might be halachic room to shorten those 5 days. This is a very contentious matter. You have rabbis on a wide spectrum in terms of how they relate to it. I think, in my experience, more and more datilu mi rabbis nowadays are being lenient about the 5th of the 5 days in cases in which a couple is struggling to conceive and it might make a difference. If you look at the classic halachic literature, you see luminaries such as Rav Zvi Pesach Frank struggling to come up with scenarios in which maybe the 5 days could somehow not be relevant, that might even involve long-term abstention between a couple, because touching the 5 days, which is such a firmly entrenched halachic practice, is not to be taken lightly. So whether or to what extent this becomes a factor in the halachic consultation really is going to depend on the rabbi, and it may or may not come into play at this stage. It also stands to reason that we should talk a little bit about alternate approaches. Now, I had the privilege as an undergraduate to study a little bit of bioethics, and I remember my teacher, Dr. Alvin Novick, Alav Shalom, no relation, who would hammer home again and again that it's not ethical to advocate a solution to a problem that isn't going to work. In other words, to suggest to a woman alternate approaches that are not necessarily going to work is not really an appropriate response. However, there are a great number of alternate approaches that have seemed to have been correlated with success in at least some women, and many of them in no way interfere with other paths, medical paths in particular, towards resolving this issue, and they're worth exploring. In particular, they're worth exploring because another factor we have in bioethical decision-making is that we want to be able to, when possible, respect patient autonomy and present them with alternatives. We don't want to misrepresent these alternatives as being efficacious as some of the medical means of addressing the issue that we'll come to in a moment. But at the same time, it's worth bringing up, for example, diet. Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Halperin, who is a great luminary in the area of Jewish medical ethics, has claimed that as many as 20% of women who struggle with this issue can have the issue improved by making adjustments to diet, like eating breakfast, what have you. There's an interplay between the insulin system and the hormonal system that it can make a difference. There are different supplements that different people have suggested. I know that Machon Pua, on a regular basis, there's a couple of supplements that they suggest that women take. There are physical things, little things. There are many women who report that by using menstrual cups, their time spent with active bleeding seems to be reduced. So, too, there are these methods that have sprouted in Israel over the past year that are sort of a, can almost call them toilet training for women who are menstruating, which involve women taking more active control over their muscles and the expulsion of blood. They make claims that sometimes they can shorten the time that a woman spends actively bleeding, which could make a difference. Again, none of these things are actually going to get in the way of treatment. At the same time, we have to be very careful if mentioning them to women who are interested in alternative approaches to these issues that we don't make some kind of overpromise. I might add to alternate approaches what Rav Volko mentioned before, which is, of course, tefillah. Medical intervention, from our perspective, is something to pursue after a medical diagnosis and a halachic consultation have taken place. That means once we know that the problem has not been, the problem exists, that's the medical diagnosis, and we know that the problem can't just easily, at least, be addressed by the tools, the halachic tools that the rabbi involved is bringing to table, at least in the beginning. A rabbi might find more lenient tools at a later stage, depending on what happens medically. There is medical intervention. Studies have found that using Clomid or estrogen at the very beginning of the cycle, whether a patch or orally, can help push off ovulation. 80 to 90% of cases respond, of halachic infertility, respond to that kind of medical intervention. There's possibility for other type of hormonal treatment. There's possibility of pursuing other type of medical interventions that might shorten bleeding. That's an avenue that hasn't been taken as widely. As a last medical resort, and this is something that many women have a lot of difficulty with, it's not something that we mention lightly, is artificial insemination. The reason why it could be on the table is because it's a way, as it were, to preserve the halachic system, while also, if other medical avenues have exhausted themselves, while also enabling a woman to conceive. It does bring up a lot of challenges in and of itself. First of all, of course, artificial insemination, there are questions about procuring the sperm, which raise any number of halachic issues. There's also the issue, these have been addressed, of course, for classic fertility cases, the issues of the woman and her need of status when she's being inseminated. But it is a possibility, it is a possibility, and it's on the table. What these medical solutions have in common is that they can be difficult both for the patient and for the physician. They can pose an ethical difficulty for the patient, and that the patient is experiencing what's perceived as a religious issue. And there's an ever-widening or escalating track of medical interventions that are suddenly getting involved to solve it. That can be difficult for the patient. Why should someone, women have said this to me, why should I be pursuing artificial insemination when there's nothing wrong with my body? We can do this without. It's just the halacha. Why are you pursuing medical solutions for halachic problems? That's a major issue for many patients. Of course, one part of a response could be, of course, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has something to do with the availability of these medical solutions as well. It's not as though the great advances in modern medicine and our ability to respond to them has nothing to do with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. But that's not always the most satisfactory answer. From a physician's perspective, there can also be an ethical concern in that patients who come with these issues are in effect asking for medical treatment when they're not presenting a physical problem. Now, of course, physicians prescribe contraceptive pills or hormone treatments to women for any number of reasons, not all of them 100% really medically warranted. The husband is going to have a certain type of schedule with travel, and they want to manipulate the cycle, or the woman wants to improve her skin and acne, and these things seem to be taken more lightly. And even so, it's not a trivial consideration, which in particular, a physician not coming from a religious Jewish background might struggle with in trying to work with this type of patient. Putting things together, what should we do? I wrote up here, I'm very happy with what Rebecca said, because it's worth noting I wrote here couple-centered approach, sort of a translation of the patient-centered approach, and that's because very much along the lines of what Rebecca was suggesting earlier, this is a matter whether we're addressing it halachically, and that's going to affect how the woman is observing Hilchot Nida, or whether we're addressing it medically. The husband should be a part of the process. He's also a stakeholder in this dilemma. What we like to see is physicians and rabbis communicating with each other or working together, or at least the patient not feeling, or the questioner not feeling, that they're working against each other. The more that the woman or the couple facing this issue feels that the rabbis are on top of the medical issues and are responsive to them, and that the physicians are sensitive to their halachic commitments and concerns, the better position that person is to get the best of all worlds in terms of potential ways to solve the problem. Personalization to the extent possible, it's not one size fits all. It's not clear, there's no clear obligation for a woman to pursue, let's say, medical treatment for this issue. Giving people, not just respecting their autonomy in presenting different options to them, but also really listening to them in terms of what solutions they might want to pursue when is also very, very important in helping to restore a sense of agency and help women in particular who are struggling with a feeling of helplessness when they're dealing with these problems. What we've seen is that really very many of these cases can be resolved without great undue difficulty on the part of the woman if the different members of the team can help facilitate her education and her communication. And that's really the most important thing to me to communicate here. It's a real issue. It might not be as prevalent as we might think. And the more we look into it appropriately when women turn to us, the more we see that perhaps its prevalence is not as great as originally thought. But everyone stands to win when the patient feels that her needs and her husband's needs are being addressed with sensitivity in a collaborative spirit by anyone who might touch the issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lori. The next two sessions are going to be, the next two talks are going to be sort of seen to be in tandem, and we're going to move now to more clinical scenarios relating to some clinical practice. With us this weekend and Shabbos, we had Dr. Paul Klayman with us, who is from Ottawa himself. He is actually a specialist in reproductive medicine. He's a professor at the University of Ottawa in obstetrics and gynecology. And he himself deals with the issues of IVF and fertility in particular. I encourage you to look at his bio in the book that we have. He will be addressing when we spoke about this, and I knew he was going to be here. I met Dr. Klayman probably about 30 years ago. I doubt he would remember that, but I was a good third-year medical student at that time, and he was a good teacher. So we met back then, and then when I said to discuss some of the cases, to see some of the practical ones, so he jumped on this idea immediately. So he had some ideas. So what we're going to do is present two cases. from clinical practice. We'll build the background for those that are not medically, so that everybody has a sense of what the cases are going to be. It's going to be a little bit on technical, but Dr. Klayman assured me that he will make sure that that we get the feel of this. And then what we'll do is we'll present it to Rabbi Steinberg, who will address the actual halachic analysis of these cases, because they're individual specific cases, but they touch on much broader issues after that. And in addition, we have here with us Dr. Avi Diamond, good friend of mine, and over the year he sent me two cases, not for my halachic analysis, but just more for my curiosity in his practices as it is a moel. Some fascinating cases which came up. So together we have these four cases that we will be discussing. So the next two sessions will be going together, but keep in mind the sort of the principles that we're going to be starting with, and then I'll have Rabbi Steinberg address all of the four together. So Dr. Klayman, right here. Wonderful. Thank you. I'll get your slides up.
I'm going to describe these two cases that came to me recently. We run a large fertility institute here in Ottawa with 7 fertility specialists and a whole team of people. I'll describe the cases, and then I need to explain to the audience a little bit about the technical issues, which I'm going to try to help you understand. But in brief, there's a condition called Turner syndrome, where girls are basically born most of the time they're already in the menopause. They don't have any eggs at all. But as they grow up, if they want to have children, nowadays with the technology of in vitro fertilization, we can take eggs from another woman, fertilize them with the woman who has Turner syndrome's husband's sperm. We can prepare the uterus of the recipient with hormones. And in fact, the technology was in large part developed in Israel by a colleague, Neri Laufer, who I'm sure Rabbi Steinberg knows. And we do it quite well nowadays. The first case is a 40-year-old professor, a scholar, very educated, analytical mind. She's married late, and she herself has Turner syndrome. Now, keep in mind as I go through the cases, most people here who did go to medical school remember that if you have your first child as you're getting into your late 30s, early 40s, there's a much higher incidence, irrespective of any underlying medical problems, of life-threatening hypertensive or high blood pressure problems that can be life-threatening for women who are having their first baby as they get older. This 40-year-old woman, she's been seeing a colleague of mine who's not Jewish, and she hears that Dr. Klayman is an Orthodox Jew, and she comes to me before she does this egg donation at our center wanting to know whether it's better to find an egg donor who's Jewish, whether the child is Jewish if the egg donor is not Jewish, and I'm Jewish and I give birth to the baby. Are there these kind of problems? What I was surprised to learn is that she didn't know that there is an issue that we'll talk about where she's actually at risk for sudden death due to an explosion of the major blood vessels in her chest in late pregnancy. And that really was the main issue to me. In terms of who the mother is, the egg donor and all that, I suggested she see her rabbi. As a doctor, I was worried about more profound problems. My colleague had arranged that she had a normal echocardiogram. There were no obvious anatomic problems with the major vessels in the heart. The second case is a 37-year-old woman who has a 2-year-old daughter, and the 2-year-old daughter has been diagnosed with Turner syndrome. And this 37-year-old consulted with a colleague of mine who's just about to retire. And this 37-year-old woman thought, wow, this is great. My poor daughter will never be able to have children. But when my daughter marries, wouldn't it be nice for my daughter to say to my son-in-law, she can have my baby? I'll give my eggs, this 37-year-old mother said, so that my daughter will have the genetic heritage of our family. Can you imagine going on a shidduch and saying, you know, we can have my mother's children? This patient I met actually when I was the doctor assigned to harvest her eggs, and we harvested 27 eggs that are now being frozen. Probably they'll be used long after my colic is gone. So the issue is that this condition of Turner syndrome is, as many in the room know, to be a normal person, you have to have 46 chromosomes. A boy has an X and a Y chromosome, and a girl has two X's. So if you have an X chromosome and don't have the pair, so you have only you have only one X chromosome and not its pair, you end up with this condition called Turner syndrome. And these kids tend to be very short. They have a certain kind of look to them. I don't want to get into all the medical issues. The main issue that is relevant for today's discussion is that A, most of these girls, as I mentioned, are born without any eggs. Sometimes they will have menstrual periods and go into the menopause in their teenage years or in their 20s. And the main thing, though, for today's discussion, vis-a-vis the risks, is that a very high proportion, as I mentioned briefly, have defects in the anatomy of the major vessels going from the heart. This major blood vessel called the aorta, in a high proportion of these girls, the aorta is constricted. It's called coarctation of the aorta. So in order for the heart to pump blood around the body in a normal Turner syndrome girl, the heart has to pump a lot harder. And a lot of these people, they do fine. They don't have even a lot of exercise intolerance. The problem is, though, that when you become pregnant and your heart, your circulating blood volume increases 30 to 50% during pregnancy, your heart in any woman has to pump a lot more. Well, if you already have an anatomic problem, that's going to be problematic. And if you have an obvious anatomic problem, any doctor knows that trying to have a baby with Turner syndrome is an absolute contraindication. The problem is that in many of these women, they don't have obvious anatomic problems, but it turns out that the internal structure of the lining of the blood vessels, the walls of the major blood vessels, is defective. And when this when you have a defective blood vessel, what can happen during a lot of blood flow that happens in pregnancy that doesn't happen when you're not pregnant, is you get what's called a dissecting aneurysm, where the blood of these major blood vessels ends up getting in between the inner lining of the wall and the muscle of the wall, and the internal lining of the wall obstructs that major blood vessel, and the whole system explodes and leads to sudden death in late pregnancy. This is a microscopic picture of the wall of the major blood vessel, the aorta, that carries blood from the heart to the rest of the body. And these little holes, these little empty areas, are not normal. These are cystic changes that occur in the wall of the blood vessel in these girls that you cannot tell if this is happening by using MRI or echocardiogram. So this problem occurs if it's a late pregnancy. This is behind the chest wall. It can be very sudden and unexpected and lead to sudden death. It doesn't happen normally when you're not pregnant, again, because pregnancy has this huge demand for an increase in blood volume. This is just explaining how the blood volume increases during normal pregnancy. And of course, in this situation where you're already compromised, you may not tolerate it. I don't want to These slides are just reviewing these physiologic changes that occur during normal pregnancy, that this woman who has these problems that you may not even know about because they're secreted, you can only find out if you take the aorta out and do histologic sections, are going to show that she may not tolerate it. So the problem is that it happens late in pregnancy. You can't always know that there's an anatomic problem, and so the question is whether or not they're allowed to have a baby. So these patients, they come to us to try to have children, but there is some risk of death through aortic dissection. Unfortunately, many of my colleagues, because this condition is not such a common problem presenting to a fertility center, many clinicians who practice my field of medicine are not aware of the importance of screening these women even for these anatomic defects. Furthermore, we don't have a lot of information about what happens to them. My colleague Megan Karnas, she's actually here now in Toronto, she practices fertility medicine, published the only large-scale review of all cases in the United States when she was training in her fellowship. And she found really the problem is that fertility centers, once we see an embryo's heart beating inside a patient, we send them off to the obstetrician. Very, very few fertility centers then go out to find out exactly what happened at the end of the pregnancy. These patients are lost to follow-up. So we don't really have any really hard data on what happens to these young women when they end up getting pregnant. But what she's learned is that even presumably in those cases that were screened to rule out major anatomic defects, that probably as much as 2% risk of women who have Turner syndrome who become pregnant, even if maybe they don't have any obvious anatomic defects found on MRI scans or echocardiogram, have a risk of sudden death in late pregnancy. And this is, these slides are just reiterating this concept. So back to the case. Can this highly educated scholar, she's a professor at a university here in Canada in an analytical field, marrying late, who at age 40, even if she doesn't have Turner syndrome, has a much higher chance that in late pregnancy she could develop hypertensive complications of pregnancy that itself are life-threatening. She has, by the way, a normal echocardiogram, and it sent her to a cardiologist who did an MRI. That's all normal. The cardiologist agrees that we don't know what the risks are. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine practice recommendations are that you don't allow someone to have a baby with egg donation with Turner syndrome if they have coarctation of the aorta or obvious other great vessel problems. And we should tell the patient that they have as much as a 2% of risk of sudden death in late pregnancy, and with patient autonomy and counseling, allow the patient to make the decision. But in halacha, my question, Rav Steinberg, is she allowed to try to have a baby? And irrespective of whether she's allowed, as a physician, if she comes to me and says, no, I'm going to do it anyway, am I allowed to do an embryo transfer into such a patient? And then the second question, the 37-year-old woman who has a 2-year-old daughter now comes 27 mature eggs for her daughter. Will her daughter now grow up and feel compelled to put her life at risk because of the legacy left to her by her mother? And how about the issue, can her, this little girl who's going to go out and get married, can that boy have his mother-in-law's children? Are they his mother-in-law's children? I mean, who is the mother? Even if a surrogate carries those eggs, maybe the Turner syndrome baby has coarctation of the aorta and not allowed to carry them. So Rav Steinberg and colleagues, these are the questions I leave with to try to discuss here in the session. Thank you very much. Any questions of the clinical issues before the Rabbanim address the issue? Okay, thank you.
I have one question. There's absolutely absolutely no test you can do to look at the internal structure of the aorta to see if they have any
For the cystic changes in the medial necrosis issue, there's no way of checking for it. And the problem is we don't know the exact percentage of people who will die in late pregnancy irrespective of normal anatomic studies. In normal anatomic study, if you have coarctation or these other kind of obvious, but this patient of mine, by the way, has a bicuspid aortic valve, but the cardiologist is not concerned about it. My concern is, if you already have a bicuspid aortic valve, which is associated with the condition, could she, is that a higher chance that she has cysts? Nobody knows. There's not enough data because they're, A, too rare. They're spread all over the world, and no one, there's not any long-term follow-up, unfortunately. But there's a real risk, at risk of using halachic terminology, is it shchiach if it's 1%, 2% risk? Enough that you're not allowed to get pregnant, or is it okay if you have patient autonomy and you want to take the unknown risk?
Is Turner syndrome more common in Jews than...
No, it's not more common in Jews. Yes?
What is the relative risk for a healthy, supposedly healthy 40-year-old to the country of
sudden death? It's not increasing. They have other cardiac problems, but, I mean, the point is that pregnancy definitely increases the risk of sudden death in late pregnancy. That's clear. Yeah.
You have a 2% risk of sudden death with coarctation in late...
Oh, it's higher than that. No, it's higher... If you have coarctation...
I mean, in person, we've not proven coarctation yet.
We don't know. It may be the American Society, based on Megan Karnes's paper, which extrapolated from the data available... It may be as much as 2% risk, but nobody really knows exactly what the risk is for Turner's girls having a pregnancy who have been screened for anatomic defects when it's considered an absolute contraindication.
What's the general risk in late pregnancy?
Sudden death is 1 in 300,000, bismanenu. Yeah, it's rare nowadays.
Thank you very much, Dr. Klayman. So the stage has been set in terms of dealing with these questions, and they will deal with sort of the issues, of course, and Rabbi Steinberg will come up and address them. What is the nature of this risk, and what is it? It basically gets into the question of what kind of risk can we get into.
Who's the mother?
Hold on. And then, who is my mommy? So for that, and there will be four slides on the cases. So the idea for the next little while will be to go through the four cases. Rabbi Steinberg will do that, and then to go back to the entire. We'll have the panel. We'll have some questions for the morning. If there are some, so we'll bring the panel back up, and if there are questions that deal with some of the other topics that we've discussed, then we will close up with that. So we'll just run a continuous loop here. Rabbi Steinberg.
So this is the first case just presented. What happened?
Oh, it's not in slide mode yet. It's not in presentation mode.
You know this? Okay, so this is the first case. I'll come back to it in a moment.
Close PowerPoint and open it again.
We can see it.
Just
read it.
They won't see it at the back.
Okay, so the second case as was presented. A third case, and I'll read it, 50-year-old single male and a Kohen. He wants a son who will be a Kohen. He chooses a surrogate egg donor and a surrogate gestational carrier who are both Jewish. The question is, who is the mother, and is the child a Kohen? In the fourth case, Jewish parents who own their own biological sperm and egg, father who is a sperm donor is a Levi, they hire a non-Jewish surrogate. The bris was done l'shem gerus. The question is this child a Levi? And after surrogate implanted, mother gets pregnant and gives birth to a baby girl 6 weeks before the surrogate gives birth to their son. What is the relationship of the siblings? Okay, these are real cases.
Avi, where are you? These are real cases, right?
Yeah. Couldn't make them up.
So they're real.
Okay. So in order to make some sense before we go into the details, because each case has a caveat to it, but there are several things that are mutual to all of them. So to begin with, how do we define a father and how do we define a mother halachically? We discussed it in previous conferences, but for the interest of those who weren't then and for those who forgot already, I'll try to sum up some of the principles without going into all the sources, who thinks what and why. So let's start with a father. That's always easier. With the male, it's always an easier task. A father is the sperm donor, no matter who he is, unless he's not Jewish. A Gentile male is not a father, halachically. But a Jewish male who is the sperm donor is the father, even if the
thank God it was just that one. Okay,
so
no,
the,
not okay.
The male sperm donor is always the father, even if the child is a mamzer. Even if the male Jew who donated the sperm either by direct relationship or indirect relationship, and the result is that the child is a mamzer because it was inseminated into a married Jewish woman to a man other than the sperm donor, the sperm donor is the father of the mamzer. Second point, Kohen Levi Israel go according to the father. The mother is irrelevant for this issue. So if the sperm donor, who is the father, is a Kohen, his son is a Kohen. If the sperm donor is a Levi, his son is a Levi, and so on. So that is on the father's side. There are today more complicated situations where the sperm is obtained while the person is still alive, but he dies before the sperm is inseminated. Will he be still considered the father, although the sperm that created the child was inserted after he passed away? And even more complicated is that we can get sperm from a dead man and inseminate, so the sperm wasn't even in the world while the male was in the world. Is he still the father because he is the sperm owner, or it's impossible for someone to become a father after he dies and even his sperm wasn't in the world? So these are more complex problems, but they don't relate to either of the four cases. So from the father's side, the male donor of sperm is the father always, if he's Jewish, and Kohen Levi Israel is determined by him. On the mother's side, it's much more complicated. And the reason is that to be a father, you only have to participate with the 50% of the genetic material, and you become a father, right? So you can donate the sperm, go for a trip for 9 months, come back, and Moshe goes, I'm the father, right? Because you don't need to do anything else more. That's what defines you as a father. Whereas a mother is equal to the father by donating the other 50% of the genetic makeup of the child by her egg, but she also has to carry the pregnancy in the liver. She can't give the egg and go away and the child will be born from the air, right? Someone has to carry the pregnancy in the liver. So a mother has dual function in order to become a mother. She has to give the 50% of the genetic material and she has to carry the pregnancy in the liver. So up to recent times, there was always the same woman who both donated the 50% of the genetic material and carried a pregnancy in the liver. Nowadays, we can separate the two functions of the mother into two different women. One is giving the egg, and one is carrying the pregnancy in the livers. So one is the egg donor, and one is a surrogate, right? So who of the two now is the mother? In other words, what constitutes motherhood, more importantly, within the two functions of motherhood? And that has how many answers in halacha? That has four answers in halacha. So there's one answer that really is out. I mean, Tzitz Eliezer said it, but then he himself retracted that neither is the mother. Because in order to be a mother, you have to do the two functions in one woman. And if you, like, there is no half pregnancy, there is no half mother. That doesn't exist. That was his idea. But that would create a lot of problems. I won't go into the difficulties, and there's no source to say it. He thought there is a Rami Pano that says it, but really it doesn't. Anyway, that I think can be put aside. So we are left with three options. One option is that what counts is the genetic material equal to the male part. The male part is a father because he gives his genetic material. Equally, the woman is a mother if she gives her genetic material. And the carrying and delivery is an incubator. It's irrelevant from the definition of motherhood. That is one school of thought, and there are several points in the Gemara that allude to this option. The opposing option is that only the carrying and delivering woman is the mother. The egg is a chip made in Japan. It's irrelevant. It's something that we don't see. It's something technical. It doesn't constitute motherhood. Motherhood is the bonding of the body of the two parts, the fetus and the mother. And today with epigenetics, it might even have a real contribution to the child, to the development of the child. And therefore, there's a school of thought that say that only the mother who carries the pregnancy and delivers is the mother, and the other one is irrelevant. The two of the major poskim of our generation, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Eliashiv, disagreed with the two positions. And they claimed that there is no halachic source to define who is a mother if you divide the two parts. All the sources that have been brought by those who say that the egg donor is the mother, or those who say that the pregnant and delivering woman is the mother, all the sources were refuted by them. And again, I don't have the time to go over so many sources, but they looked into it, and they decided that we can't solve the problem nowadays. There's no source to this unique situation that occurred in this generation. But the Gemara is full of situations where the Gemara didn't know how to answer a shaila, and what is the end in the Gemara? Teiku, right? So here we have a teiku. But a teiku doesn't mean that we don't know what to do. We have to find a solution. Here is a child. We have to tell him who is he and who is his mother, right? So their solution is that both women are mothers. Who says that a person has only one mother? So in this case, he has two mothers, but only lechumra. And I'll give you a few examples that will be relevant to the cases here. What does it mean, lechumra? So for instance, Jewishness obviously goes according to the mother. The father is irrelevant. It can be a Jew, it can be a non-Jew. The child will not be dependent, whether he's Jewish or not, on the status of the father. It's only the mother that counts. So let's say the egg donor is a Gentile woman and the surrogate mother is a Jewish mother. If you go by the egg donor as the mother, this child is a full goy, right? If you go by the surrogate delivering a woman as the mother, this child is a full Jew. But if you both are mothers lechumra, so lechumra he is a goy. So he needs a giur lechumra in order to enter the Am Yisrael. And vice versa, obviously the same thing. If the surrogate is a Gentile and the egg donor is Jewish, again, lechumra, he will be considered goy lechumra, which means that he needs a gir lechumra. We'll get into the nuances, what's the difference between a goy gamur and a goy lechumra. There are halachic differences between them. So this is one issue that the chumra will play a role. Another issue will be, who can this child marry or not marry? Obviously, he can't marry a sister, right? So let's say the egg donor has another child, a female child, and she donated her egg to another woman who delivered a male, a boy. Can this male marry that girl? So if we say that the egg donor is irrelevant, then it's not a sister by halachic criteria. It's half a sister genetically, but halachically, if she's not a mother, so she is strange to him, so he can marry her. But if the egg donor is the mother, so this is half a sister of his, and he can't marry his sister, right? And vice versa. And we can go on and on with a lot of examples of inheritance, of kibbutz avim, who do we regard as a mother? So if we say lechumra, so in the last example, he can't marry either a sister from this woman or a sister from that woman, because both women are his mother's lechumra, and obviously he can't marry half a sister because the child will be a mamzer by halachic definition. So depending on how you define halachically who is the mother, some of these questions will be answered, right? So let's start from the beginning. And now I'm talking only about the issue who is the mother and what the consequences are, and we'll come to each case with their specific added nuances. So if we have a 40-year-old Turner syndrome woman that will carry the pregnancy and deliver, but she will get an egg from a different woman. If the egg given to her will be a Gentile woman, then the child born will be lechumra, her child, but will require giyur lechumra, right? Because the egg donor is not Jewish. If, on the other hand, the egg donor will be Jewish, then the child doesn't need giyur, but the child is not allowed to marry a sibling from that woman. How do we assure that it will not happen? How do we know in 18 years or 20 years from now that whoever this child meets is not his half-sister? So we need a registry. We need to know who the egg donor is if it's a Jewish woman, right? So there are advantages to take an egg donor from a Jewish woman, and there are advantages to take an egg donor from a non-Jewish woman. And it's not clear which is better, because if you take it from a Gentile woman, you need giyur. If you take it from a Jewish woman, you need to keep records to assure that a brother will not marry a sister. Halachic. Excuse me? Well, whether DNA is sufficient to make such a distinction is still a very debatable question.
Of siblings?
Even of siblings. It's a debatable question. It may be in the future people will accept it, then you can solve it. But that would mean that every time he meets a girl, he needs to do a DNA to know if this is his half-sister, which I don't know how people would like to do. So, answering the question, she wants to know if she needs to find a Jewish egg donor for the child to be Jewish. Yes, if she wants the child to be Jewish, the egg donor has to be a Jewish woman. If we go according to the Shita, that we don't know the answer and we go lechumra. If this woman will ask a poisek who will say that the egg donor is totally irrelevant and the mother is only the pregnant and delivering mother, and she is doing that, so it's irrelevant who the egg donor is, so she can take anyone.
Unless she moves to Israel when
Rav Amar Paskin the opposite.
Right, no. I'm saying either you go according to Rav Amar and Rav Avadi Yosef that the egg donor is 100% the mother and the caring mother is irrelevant, then the question comes up. Or she goes according to Rav Eliashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman that at least, doubtfully, the egg donor is a mother. But if she goes according to Zalman Nehemia Goldberg or Rav Mordechai Eliyahu or others who hold that the egg donor is irrelevant, then it becomes irrelevant.
Is there a policy in the state of Israel?
Right, so in Israel at the moment, and things may change, you know that different opinions come up and go down. But currently, since both Rav Eliashiv and Rav Auerbach said that there is no solution and you have to go lechumra, most of the batedinim that I know of take this position.
Even though they're not alive and Rav Zalman
But I spoke with his son-in-law, if you want a secret from the room, and he told me that he feels strongly that he's right, but because his father-in-law decided what he decided, he doesn't pass it. So if you go to ask him, he won't tell you that the mother is only the delivering mother, practically speaking.
Didn't
he
say that she could choose the non-Jewish egg donor?
Yes, she can choose, but she has to know the consequences. So I'm saying
the child has to be converted as a child.
As a baby. Whenever you can put her in a mikveh, you can't do it for a newborn baby, you wait a few months and you do it. We'll come back to the issue of a male born from this issue, what do you do at the bris? That's a complicated matter by itself. We'll come back to it. So I'm saying, depending on the three shittas that I described, the answer will be which is preferable to take, what kind of egg this woman should ask for.
Rav Steinberg, you've got the situation where Rav Eliashiv 20 years ago made a psak that whoever gives birth is the mother, and they went to Europe and had a goyisha egg donor. They brought this kid up as a firm kid. Now he goes to make a shidduch, and he finds, according to the current policy now, he's a goy.
Right. So that is the problem that I think we do it in Israel now. Whenever there is an egg or surrogate involvement, we tell them, you should know that what we tell you now may change when the child will be of marrying age, because this is a developing field. It's not yet settled. What can we do? That's a fact of life.
Then it was a non-observant family, you got issues of fear. I mean,
it's
really,
really complicated.
You can't marry if it's a girl and you title her, if you convert her, that you can't marry a co-mingle.
Right. We'll come to this in a minute. Very, very important question.
It's only half a problem if the things change before she gets married. What happens if she got married and then changed?
Oh, right. Well, the deal she always can do, that's even after marriage. Right. That is the state of the art. I can't give you better answers. That's where we are at now. If you talk about now this is what most Batadinim rule. Whether it will stay that way in 10 years or in 50 years, I don't know. Now, the next case. Is this the next case?
Next slide, that one there, the 37.
Right. So the next case, we have the question of egg donor who is the mother of the caring woman, right? So if it would have been through direct relationship, if let's say one man who had relations with his wife and his mother-in-law, right? That would be an Isur Kores. Right. And the child will be a mamzer if he gets it from his mother-in-law, right? But this doesn't happen in this case. In this case, there's no direct relationship between a man and the two women.
The mother-in-law may be gone from this world.
She may be gone, but the child was born from her egg. And then we come back to the question, can you be a mother after you die? Like, can you be a father after you die? So the current understanding, except for Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, is that there is no mamzerus unless the child is born with direct relationships. So either egg donation or artificial insemination, even from a Jew to a married woman, the child is not considered mamzer according to most poskim. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu held that it is a mamzer, doesn't matter the way the child was brought to the world. If he was brought to the world by relations that halachically make a mamzer, he is still a mamzer. Most other poskim hold that mamzerut has two components. One is the forbidden type of relationship, and B, the way the child was born. It has to be done in a natural way and not in an unnatural way. Avshalom Zalman Neubach has a different opinion. He thinks it's a Sofek mamzer. And halachically, a Sofek mamzer is even worse than a mamzer, because a mamzer halachically is allowed to marry a mamzeret. But a Sofek mamzer cannot marry anyone. So that is even a worse position. But except for these two poskim, all other poskim, as a principle, say that there is no mamzerus unless there was direct relationship between the forbidden parties. So if this mother would donate her egg to her daughter and a child would be born, technically, according to most poskim, and again, maybe when this child grows up, everyone will turn and think like Arab Mordechai Eliyahu, then she'll be a mamzer, that will be a major problem. But at the moment, according to most poskim, she will not be a mamzer. But there are a lot of studies to show that psychologically, I don't know a lot, but there are studies to show that psychologically that is a bad idea. It is not good to have a child that his grandmother is his mother, and all this confusion of people who live together and come together on many occasions, the child will be very confused. Better to take an egg from someone distant who disappears from the life of this couple, and the child grows like the child of this couple, and it's much healthier psychologically. So psychologically, it may be not a good idea, although the mother has good intentions, but it might be a bad idea. But halachically, again, as I say, except for Shlom Zalman Neubach and Arav Mordechai Eliyahu, all other poskim would not consider it a mamzer. Okay? The third case on that issue, here we have a Kohen who has a surrogate egg donor and a surrogate gestational carrier who both are Jewish. So since both are Jewish, the child born is Jewish. Right? And since the father is always the sperm donor, and the sperm donor here is a Kohen, so the child will be a Kohen. So that is relatively easy to answer. And who's the mother? We discussed already how to go through the different
positions.
Can she
be a married woman?
Excuse me?
A woman can be married?
Yeah.
And
well, except for Arav Mordechai Eliyahu. But unless you don't take Arav Mordechai Eliyahu position, then there's no mamzerus even for a married woman if it's not done by direct relationship. And the fourth case is more complicated, because here we have a father who is Jewish and Levi. By the same token, you can say Kohen, it doesn't matter, but he has something specific about him. But the mother, at least the surrogate mother, is a Gentile. Now, I assume that the egg donor, yeah, it says so, that the egg donor was a Jewish mother, right? So now, the decision here was to do the bris l'shem geirus. Now, was it done l'shem geirus, assuming that the Gentile surrogate is the mother halachically, like Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, and therefore you need a full geirus? Or was it done only Gerus Lechumra because maybe the egg donor is the mother, and as the egg donor mother, the child is Jewish? So according to Shlomo Zalman Neubach and Rabbi Yashiv, you need a Giyur, but only Lechumra. What would be the difference? So first of all, if the Gerus is a full-fledged Gerus, then Ger Shenitgayer Ketinok Shenolad. Right? So he's not Levi. He can't be a Levi because now he is a new entity. So that obviously takes away all his relationship to his father. But if we do it the Chumrah only, so I think, and I discussed it with some of the poskim on similar cases, that it doesn't matter. Because once there is a Giyur, and it is the Chumrah, what is the Chumrah here? That he is not related to his father. That would be a Chumrah. And that means that he is not a Levi, the same way as it would have been done as a full Gerus. There is a Chiddush by Reb Osher Weitz, who holds that indeed he agrees with from Zalman Neuerbach and Rav Eliashiv that we can't solve the problem and therefore both mothers are mothers lechumra. But in his opinion, the Giur lechumra is only because to enter Am Yisrael you want the person to be as clean Jewish as possible. But it doesn't necessarily go to other areas. So for instance, as you asked, if this would not have been a boy, if this would have been a girl who underwent full gerus, she obviously will not be able to marry a kohen. A giyoret and a grusha cannot be married for a kohen. He claims that if it's only a giyor lechumra, she would be able to marry a kohen. It's a big chiddush, very difficult to understand. He has some reasoning about it. I don't think anyone agrees with him so far, but things, as we say, may change. So I don't know what he would say on Levi and Cohen situation if it's only Lechumra, the same way as he thinks that Lechumra is good enough that she should marry a Cohen, so maybe it's good enough that he is still the father, and if it's a male, he will remain a Levi or a Cohen. But that would be only a minority opinion at the moment. So whether it is a full Gerus or a Giur Lechumra, he loses his Levi status. There's another issue. What brochas do you make in this bris? Because the brochas that we make on a regular bris of a Jew on the eighth day, there are two brochas. There's Alamila, and there's Lachniso Bebris Hashem Avraham Avinu. If you do a Giur Mila, you do a Mila for Giur, the brocha is Lamul et Agerim, and there is no Lachniso Bebris Hashem Avraham Avinu. If you have a Sofek and you do the Bris Misofek, which brochas will you say, and how will you say it?
Sofek brochas. Sofek brochas
lahak. So you won't say any brochas.
One way. Doesn't sound right.
Both Reb Osher Weitz, I discussed it both with Reb Osher Weitz and with Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, and both independently said that you say Alamila because Alamila is sort of a generic broche. It's a general broche. So even if it's for Giyu, and instead of saying Lamul et Agerim, you said Alamila, probably it's okay. It's like Shahakol is good for everything, but preferably that you should say Borei Pri Haetz if it's a fruit, rather than to say Shahakol. But if you say Shahakol, it's fine. So Alamila is fine for both sides. But Lachniso, that is already Sofek Brochets, because if he is a Goy, there is no takona to say this Brocher, and Sofek Brachot Lakel, so you shouldn't say Lachniso. Zalman Nechemya told me that he assumes, he was very sensitive, that not everyone that came to the bris knows the whole story. And obviously the parents don't want everyone to know that something fishy happened here and it's not a regular child that was born to them, right? So if you say Alamila, everyone says, good, omeg, fine. All of a sudden you don't say Lachniso, something happened here, right? So they start shushkit. So he says, mumble something. When the time comes, just mumble something. Anyway, no one pays attention. But they won't feel that something wrong happened. So, if you want, next time, you can do it.
Yeah, but what if this child will have a Kohen gene? And he's not a Kohen.
Right. Well, The Cohen gene and the Jewish gene are a major dispute at the moment. I am now involved, when I'm coming back, with a major meeting on these issues, how reliable it is for halachic purposes. You know, the one that is the great force on it is your Canadian fellow, Karl Skoretsky, and he's coming to Jerusalem, and we are having a meeting with Rabbonim, and we are going to discuss how reliable it is. If it will turn out that indeed it's very reliable, maybe we can solve it. But at the moment, it's not accepted as reliable enough. So we'll see what happens with that. But I'm talking about the principles of halacha involved.
On the mumble, you suggest doing it without shame or mumble?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good mumble.
Yeah. You can say without Shemo Malchus, but then if someone will listen, say Shushkes again.
Keep on Shushking
and Malchus.
So do whatever you want, just don't mention Hashem. Well, so the question of Piriya Verivya by itself is very complicated in modern fertility because, again, except for Ramot Taliyahu, most poskim hold that to be Mekayim Piriya Verivya, you have to do it in the natural way. So if a child is born by modern fertility technologies, you anyway didn't Mekayim Piriya Verivya. So you're doing it only for the good feeling that you want a child, which is a child. He's a normal child, and he's your child. Everything is fine, but the mitzvah you didn't fulfill. So that is a separate issue, how to do it.
Why don't you get the mitzvah called Hamagadol?
Well, so that is Keilu, but it's not the real period of Olivia. Kol Hamagadol is as if he allowed it, but it's not that he allowed it. Now, the interesting case here is sort of the story of Avrom, Hagar, and Sarah, right? Sarah couldn't have children. Avrom took a surrogate mother, right? Took Hagar. And after Hagar gave birth to a child, Sarah all of a sudden gave birth. And that happens quite frequently. I know, and I'm sure those who are in fertility and medicine know that when something doesn't go well and you do some fertility technologies, all of a sudden, a normal child is born.
Even in this case, he has a sister.
Right. So I'm saying, this is very, it's not unusual that happens. They went to a surrogate because they thought they can't have children, and all of a sudden she became pregnant. Now, the question is, what will be the relationship between the girl that was conceived naturally and the boy that came from the surrogate non-Jewish woman? That would depend on how this girl obviously is the daughter of the two people, right? Of the man and the woman. That's a natural child. But the male that was born out of a Gentile surrogate would depend how you define his mother. If the Gentile woman is his mother and he needs conversion, then technically, halachically, they are not brothers and sisters. They can even marry each other.
So the Chumrah comes out
of the Kula. But if we go, I'm saying, if you take it as a Vada, if the surrogate mother is the mother, if you go by this
Rabbi,
position.
Sorry, in this case, the surrogate mother is the egg and the womb.
Well, there are two.
No, they inseminated into a surrogate mother, and she became pregnant with the husband's sperm.
Right.
No, the father non-Jewish surrogate.
No. The case is that the father, who is the sperm donor, they inseminated into a non-Jewish surrogate, right?
With a Jewish egg?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, with a mother, okay. with a wife. Yeah.
So according back to what you were saying.
So I'm saying that if you go, not Lachuma, if you know, let's say you go according to Avzal Menachemia's original position, that the surrogate mother is the mother. The egg donor is irrelevant. So this mother is a Gentile. So the son born is a total goy, and you need to convert him. Once he's converted, he has no brotherhood relationship with his sister, who genetically is his sister, but not halachic. If you go to Chumrah, then the Chumrah, it's half a sister, and therefore you can't marry her. Right?
But if you're only taking it from Chumrah, so then means you're saying that they're not, that it's
a shame. No, so I'm saying the Chumrah, they are brother and sister for purposes of not being married together. Because maybe the egg donor is the mother.
That's a different question.
Okay. Now, is this clear, this complex thing?
Is there a Bechor problem?
Well, Peter Rechem is irrelevant on how you define who the mother is. Peter Rechem is related to the woman. If she gave birth the first time, the child born is a Bechor. Now, if the Bechor is born to a Gentile woman, then he's a goy, so there's nothing to talk about. But if he was born to a Jewish woman, even if you would say that halachically his mother is someone else, she had a Peter Rechem, and therefore for her, he is a Bechor. Okay? It's a little complex.
What happens?
On the tzad that the boy would be a goy gamur, isn't there a Rabbanan from Mary's half sister because they share a father and now they've converted, or that's only if they've
both? Is what?
We know that if a full brother and sister convert to Judaism, they can't marry Midrabanan.
Right.
So would this be under the same case? Now there are
half brothers. Yeah, I mean, the Rabbanan certainly they can't marry. But I'm saying that from a principal halachic point of view, if you are sure that the Gentile woman is the mother and he converted, then halachically it's a goy who converted, who has no relationship to his biological sister. But if we go to Chumrah, maybe the mother is mutual and therefore they can't marry each other. Okay, so that is on who is the mother in these various situations. Now let's go back to the first case where there is another issue, unrelated to the question who is the mother, but related to the risks that this woman should be allowed or not allowed to take.
And can the doctor do it even if she wants?
What?
And is the doctor allowed to do it even if she says yes?
Right. So risk-taking is another whole lecture. I think you want to go home or wherever home is. Let me just give you headlines. One is not allowed to risk himself unnecessarily, no matter what the risk is. We are mechuyav v'nishmartem me'od l'nafshotechem. We have to keep guard of our body the best we can. As we discussed it yesterday, we are not the owners of our body. We ought to take good care of our body. So risk-taking is out of the question. However, there are at least two examples where risks are taken, and by the way, you are taking them every day, every time that you, for instance, drive or cross a street, you're taking a risk. I don't know in Canada, but in Israel, it's a major risk. In Israel, statistics show that over the 68 years that the state exists, there were more dead people in car accidents than all the wars and terrorist attacks combined. So there is a major risk. Are you allowed to cross the street just to go for a walk? The answer is we do it. Why do we do it?
Fatality rate is higher in Canada than it is in Israel for 100,000 kilometers.
Okay. Okay, but anyway, that's a universal risk. In Israel, it's known to be a high risk. So why are we doing it? How can we do it? I took a plane to come from Jerusalem to Ottawa with several stops. All those are risk-taking procedures. Am I allowed to do it? So the answer to it is, kevan de dash, whenever something is done on a regular way, even if it involves a risk, if this is the way people behave, that risk is permissible. That is the rule. And therefore, we are taking every day all kinds of risks that are natural processes of life that is called, in halachic terminology, kiven de dash dash, as long as he is used to do it, or everyone is used to do it, that is permissible. There's another variant of this principle, which is called Shomer Ptayim Hashem. God takes heed of the foolish, and we are all foolish people, we are doing foolish things, but God protects us. So if it is something done naturally and people do it, this risk we are allowed to take. The second thing is that for performing a mitzvah, sometimes we are allowed to take even a greater risk than just for going for a walk or for going to for a trip. Why? Because Shomer Mitzvah lo yeda davar ra. We have this protection of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that if we do a mitzvah, he protects us even more than being foolish. Shomer Ptayim Hashem is one level. Shomer Mitzvah lo yeda davar ra is a higher level. And that all is said if the risks are A, reasonable, and B, related to a mitzvah, and C, done by everyone. That's the norm of doing. Now, becoming pregnant is a risk. And in the days of the Talmud, it was much greater risk than a Turner syndrome becoming pregnant, right? And we don't find anyone saying, you can't take such a risk. Why should you take a risk to become pregnant when your risk is 10% or maybe 15% to die in those days, right? Because this is the natural way that women become pregnant and women deliver children. That's what they want. By the way, there's a famous Mashiach Chochma that the mitzvah spiria verivia is only for the male. The woman actually is not mechuyav. But obviously, the male can't perform the mitzvah unless he has a female. Nowadays, there are other ways, but originally, that is how it was supposed to be, right? So says the Meshech Chochma that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't impose on women the mitzvah because this mitzvah is endangering her life. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want to impose on her something that causes her danger. He imposed it on the male who doesn't have any danger by his wife becoming pregnant, right? However, women have the nature, the inborn nature that they want children. So there was not a need to tell them that it's a mitzvah. They do it because they want to do it. So they want to take this risk. So risk-taking for such circumstances is certainly something sanctioned by Halacha. You're allowed to take this risk. You know that you're taking the risk. You're allowed to take the risk. Now, nowadays, regular pregnancy does not have 2% mortality anymore. So here we have this added risk of 2% or maybe more, we don't know, but in this area of risk taking, that is halachically, in my opinion, permissible. It's not obligated. If the woman says, I don't want to take this risk, she's perfectly fine. But if she wants to take the risk, and you have to explain to her that this is the risk, and she understands the risk, and yet she wants to enter into this risk, this is a form of risk that A, fulfills in theory a mitzvah, although she is not mitzvah, but combined there is a mitzvah. This is what women do. That is derech haolam. That's how they bring children. They know that they take risk. And the risk is not a significant risk by halachic criteria. If it would have been 10% or more, would be a different story. But 1, 2, 3% is not considered a risk that you're not allowed to take. And then there is another example of risk-taking, and that is for livelihood, for parnose. That is a pasuk. Ve'elavu noseh et nafsho. Says the Gemara, if someone climbs up a high tree to take off the fruits of the tree, he may fall down and get killed. He's allowed to do it because that is how you get a livelihood. Some livelihoods entail certain risks. So the nature of the woman entails the risk of being pregnant, and pregnancy is a risky situation. But that is the nature of the world. That is how people behave, and such an amount of risk certainly is permissible to take, but she has to agree to it. She has to know it in order to take it. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
much, Rabbi Steinberg. I was going to say for clarifying that. It's certainly a very interesting discussion. We do have time, so I'm going to invite the panel, our speakers this morning. We'll see if there are people that want to ask questions in general, and this is really our last opportunity. So we'll just see how that goes, and we'll go from there. Let me just set up. Rabbi Steinberg, Rabbi Volka. Rabbi Volka, Rabbi Steinberg, Lori's here, and Dr. Clayman. If I can ask you to take the floor, we'll see if there are any questions from the audience. Okay, David.
I have a question for Rabbi Steinberg. I'm interested in the halachic parameters of what is acceptable risk. So I heard what you know. I hear what you say, and it all makes sense. But if I were to, you know, as a practitioner, say to a patient of mine, look, you know, a child has, for example, ADHD or some such condition, I'm going to give you a medication that has a 2% mortality risk. That would be considered completely outrageous. First of all, the drug would never be on the market. We wouldn't be able to dispense such a drug.
Right, because that is not derech haolam. The way that medicine is conducted in this particular case is that that is considered a higher than acceptable risk. The risk is not just the number. The number may be small or big. It depends how people behave, how people take it. In certain cases, in certain times, that would be considered a high risk. Maybe in different times, most people will have no choice and they'll take this risk. Sometimes you need to do an operation and you know that there is a risk and you're allowed to take the risk because people take such a risk. Now, if it's a 50% risk mortality, no one will operate, right? If it's 10% risk, almost everyone will operate if the alternative is that the patient will die. So it may be higher or lower percentages depending on what's the custom. How do we act in normal life?
So with respect, I fully understand that. That's what I'm saying, but at the relative risk situation, at that level, relative to a normal pregnancy in an unaffected person, a 2% risk sounds to me, a mortality risk of sudden death in pregnancy sounds to me to be outrageously high.
Sounds what?
Sounds high.
High. It may be sounding high to you, but it's not necessarily for this woman. This
I'm
woman,
relative to a normal pregnancy. I'm not saying.
Yeah, so 2%, first of all, by halachic criteria, according to most poskim, and I don't know the source for it, I admit, less than 5% is not regarded as a risk, because life is full of risks and you do it all the time within this range.
Not a 2%.
Well, I think you take risks that are more than 2% in your lifetime. Okay, so you're a very careful person.
Maybe relative to the fact that one's pregnancy itself had a 15 or 20% risk.
Right.
But so that's in the olden days. Today, that's simply not tenable anymore.
Right, but halachically, in the old days, if you would be then a physician, you would forbid any woman to become pregnant.
Maybe not, because that was the derech olam at that stage.
Yeah, but there was a very high risk. It was maybe 15 or 20% risk of mortality in those days. So by modern medical understanding, you would say, don't take such a risk.
Yeah,
but because the world is taking such a risk, I don't see the difference that such a woman says, I am willing to take such a risk, which, by the way, as was said, It's not a real number. It's a speculated number. We don't know really. We don't have.
It's probably a low number. So the question is the doctor the risk? I mean, as far as the doctor is concerned, the patient may be prepared to do it, but what is our obligation?
Our obligation is to tell the patient that he has, as far as we know, 2%, it may be more, risk in her particular condition, and it's up to her to decide.
A technical question about organ harvest. When someone survives a cardiac arrest, we place them in the ICU and put them on a hypothermia protocol. If they have a subsequent cardiac arrest, which they don't survive, and they undergo cardiac death, when does the clock start ticking halakhically for being able to harvest their organs? Do we have to warm them first, or does it start while they're still hypothermic?
I don't think it's a halakhic question. It's a medical question. If by medical criteria you are comfortable to say that he is dead in this position, which I think you shouldn't be comfortable, because if he's under hypothermia, maybe the physiology is different than if you will warm him to normal levels. But if you'll tell me that by medical criteria dead is acceptable, so it's acceptable. What we know from halacha is only that the heart is not beating and will not restart beating in this person. And by the way, a cardiac dead person can be someone that we decided not to resuscitate him anymore for different reasons, not in order for him to become an organ donor, which is legitimate sometimes. So the bottom line is that this person's heart will not restart in his body. If you are comfortable with the situation the way it is, then he's dead. If you're not comfortable, so do whatever is needed to make sure that the heart doesn't start.
So does the hypothermia affect the definition of brain death?
That certainly, because you can't diagnose brain death under hypothermic conditions. Because
so
everyone looks like brain death in hypothermia.
So to do the brain death tests, you have to rewarm.
Absolutely.
Them.
That is a medical criteria.
I see. Okay. All right. That's that.
Are there any medical ways of shortening a woman's actual bleeding time for their period?
If there's pathology, common problems include what's called an overgrowth of the womb lining or an endometrial polyp or an intracavitary fibroid tumor within the uterus. So you correct those problems. Otherwise, the principles of managing halakhic infertility, they're quite simple, and I don't mean to denigrate anything, but so they're very minimal medical interventions. Involve, as Laura had said, estrogen therapy or using drugs like clomiphene citrate to push the ovulation farther into the cycle. So limiting bleeding, if there is pathology, that's easy. Otherwise, you push the ovulation forward. Does that answer your question?
So is there a protocol for, like, is this written down in any journals? Is this
you want the recipe? Yeah, the recipe's well. The recipe for using estrogen therapy was first published by a Jewish guy, actually, De Ziegler in France. The purpose of it was to avoid insemination procedures on weekends because it's time and a half to pay staff on weekends. And the use of clomiphene citrate was first described in the journal Asia by Professor Lunenfeld in Israel in 1974. Yes, it's been published, and it's...
Where do I get the recipe for estrogen? That's what I'm looking for.
I'll give it to you.
Like, I need the recipe.
Well, you speak to me afterwards. I'll tell you the recipe. It's simple. Are you a family doctor? Or
yes.
Esther?
You should just know that Dr. Klayman has written a very fine article about halakhic infertility. It's available online, and it's worth reading, as well as Dr. Dina Zimmerman and Tova Gansel have written a series of articles, which are really the basis for the approach that I was presenting today, but there are a range of approaches. There was the same issue. Also, Dr. Klayman made two comments that I think are important about my presentation, just to fill in. Number one, that it's important to note that also the variations within the follicular stage, of course, can make a difference in terms of cycle timing, and that's substantial. Number two, that, of course, when the physician is trying to determine or pinpoint the time of ovulation, that's also an opportunity to determine or look at other possible fertility issues, in particular low ovarian reserve, which might accompany early ovulation. Thank you, Dr.
In the back.
You,
Stacy. Yeah, I must say that here in Canada, or in North America probably, there is a general respect for any social or religious needs as being part of a person's medical problem. Unfortunately, in Israel, it's become a problem. There's actually a gynecologist who's published a book on getting rid of the Shiva Yemei Nikim because in part of this halachic infertility. So I think in Israel you get the doctors who are not as sensitive to halacha, that, let me put it that way, who will, God forbid, denigrate women who are more sensitive to halacha and their needs. And why should I treat you as a doctor? Well, you should just get the rabbi to fix it for you. Where here in Canada, usually by and large, there's a lot more respect for cultural needs. Thanks especially to our cousins for pushing that message. Yes. Which is true.
One complication is that it can be difficult for a woman to know how to discuss it with her physician in a way that's going to be effective, meaning sometimes when this question arises and the physician might have at least some initial resistance or surprise to what's being presented, she finds herself in a position of almost needing to explain all of Hilchot Nida to a physician. So that can be...
Just if anyone wants to have it as a resource, in the journal Fertility and Sterility, about 5 years ago, there was a very nice article meant for family doctors and gynecologists who are treating Orthodox women as a basic primer into NIDA issues, so that any doctor has a look at it. It was a short read. I often hand it out to referring physicians or to patients to bring their family doctors. Very helpful for anybody. If you do a little quick search, I'm sure you'll find it in fertility and sterility.
Has it ever been denied from an insurance claim because of lack of medical need? If it's either fertility treatment or medical treatment, do you know of any such cases?
You have to speak to my American colleagues, because in here in Canada, it's not really, I mean, an issue. No pun intended.
Is there any treatment for male infertility?
Well, there are basically three reasons for sperm problems. The commonest being something unwell with the testicle. And in those cases, the only thing you can do is to take the sperm and use it using assisted reproductive technology to help them have children. If the tubing is obstructed between the testicle and the outside, that's usually not repairable. In a small minority of cases, it's the male infertility is due to a lack of the driving hormones from the gland under the brain called the pituitary gland. In that case, those can be replaced, and the man can produce normal sperm. But unfortunately, it's a very small minority of these cases. The rest of them, almost always, when the woman is younger, we can help them have children using assisted reproductive technology. It's no longer a limitation as it was years ago.
Can you talk about the ratio of problems?
The most problems in our region and actually in Israel are due to sperm problems, most infertility problems. So there are three reasons for infertility: either sperm problems, or problems with ovulation, which are easy to know about. If a woman has regular periods, almost always they're ovulating properly, releasing eggs. If their periods are irregular, even though they're having periods, usually they're not ovulating. And the third problem is due to damaged fallopian tubes. And not always, but most cases of damaged fallopian tubes have to do with a promiscuous lifestyle and infection. So
when there's not a lot of that going on, unless you've got irregular periods, it's almost always due to problems with sperm quality. So I would say that here in our region, about 70% of all fertility problems, at least in part, are due to a problem with male sperm. I don't know what Aaron Cicero, maybe Ralph Steinberg knows, but I would say it's probably similar.
One issue that's interesting related to that is, generally speaking, for halachic reasons, is a preference to do a full fertility workup on the woman before one is done on the man, which is, again, this gets back, I think, to Rebecca's point very much. The onus winds up being very much on the woman, and it's something to keep in mind as we deal with these cases all the time.
I don't understand what you mean. It's unfair that they do that. It's an unfair situation, especially when it becomes the blame game. In terms of the blame game, which could be part and parcel of the interaction of the husband and wife, it's good for the husband, it's good for both of them to know that before you start pointing fingers, that what the statistics are, because usually it's the woman who gets the blame, and therefore she's the one that is affected the most. So that's an important step.
You said that 70% of fertility problems are male, with the male.
That's true.
Because usually you're right, we usually think of the woman as having. And then why should we as family physicians go right to send the woman to the gynecologist? The first thing we should do is do
First you take a history.
Yeah.
Are the periods regular or are they irregular? If they are irregular, you have your diagnosis. In most of the time, that's the problem, unless there's other problems. If the periods are regular and there's no reason to think the patient has pelvic adhesions, she hasn't got a history of promiscuity, there's no symptoms of, let's say, severe menstrual cramping to indicate endometriosis, pelvic exam is normal, it's usually a sperm problem.
That's the first thing we should, after the history, the first thing we should do is then check the male.
But then you have to ask a rabbi, can he do a sperm test, and how can he do it? That's not straightforward.
Is there any difference between doing a sperm test halachically on a Gentile versus a Jewish man?
Well, a Gentile has no chiyuv of spinning sperm for not, so you can do it freely. That's only the problem for Jews. And the way to test for infertility of the male is complicated, because you need to know how to emit the sperm in order to test it.
Esther, last question.
It has to be important, but the alternative approach is that, Laurie, that you mentioned, to shorten a period, because I think women always want to do everything natural, but do any of those work? Like when you said the menstrual cup, I guess that's the Diva cup. I'm not sure why that would possibly work, but I just didn't want to be...
In terms of the menstrual cup or the different methods, is a question about how well or effectively a woman is cleaning herself out prior to initiating the Tara process, so that if there's remnants of some sort, they might come out the claim, at least with the menstrual cup. I think they have some studies to back this up, but we're not talking major, knock down 100%. Let's all run to this. Is that there's less of a tendency to have some kind of residual blood that might get in the way later. The issue, and I think this is what Dr. Clayman was referring to also, and it's complicated, is that from a physician's perspective, most of the main interventions here are very minor, almost trivial to a large extent. Once a physician gets over the obstacle of treating something medically, which is not a medical problem, it can seem very simple to go ahead. However, as you're already referencing in your question, many of the women who come to us have a very different perspective or take on things. They're very reluctant to seek medical treatment, both for sometimes for theological reasons, sometimes for health reasons, and we find that they're much more eager to pursue alternative methods. Most of what we have is anecdotal about the alternative methods. At the same time, because for the most part they don't get in the way of anything, it's usually not a problem unless, and this is part of the difficulty, unless we're in a situation where a woman, age-wise in particular, but also sometimes in terms of ovarian reserve, does not have a lot of time to work with, in which case, if she's playing around with alternative treatments and not getting a medical treatment in due time, then we're doing her a disservice. So I have to be very careful about this, and at the same time, it's very common to be coming from the patient, gives the patient also a sense of control. Some of it may be more effective than others. It's hard to know. But that's not something to belittle.
Yeah, just as I said, just a brief comment for the family doctors in the room who are interested in this. I was saying this to Lori privately. Most women who are ovulating before the 12th day of their menstrual cycle almost always will be found to have profoundly low ovarian reserve. If that's true, they don't have a lot of time. So you can try these interventions for a short period of time, but refer them fairly quickly to a reproductive endocrine specialist, because the prognosis, even with assisted reproductive technology, may be much limited if you give it 6 months, a year, year and a half. So don't spend too much time on it if you discover they're ovulating before, you know, if they're having shorter than 27-day cycles, basically. Watch out for those patients.
Okay, on behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank our panel this morning. I'd like to thank them for the entire participation for the weekend. And I'd like to thank you for being a wonderful audience.